What is the state of the Native nations in the U.S.?
What you see occurring here is nation building. We're a country that never received any reconstruction dollars.
The people who helped the first European settlers to this country are still struggling hundreds of years later. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Thanksgiving Day commemorates a moment of peace in what would become the U.S., but since then, that meal has seemed like an empty promise. The more recent history of America's Native people has been one of extermination, segregation, oppression, or assimilation into a culture that demanded they abandon their traditions. There are 3 million people in this country who identify themselves as Native American. Add another nearly 2 million more who say they are part Native American. And the statistics for those people are disturbing. They have higher rates of disease, and they die younger. The poverty rate among American Indians is 25%. On the Blackfoot Reservation in Montana, for example, unemployment is a nearly impossible to believe 69%. They have higher rates of addiction to drugs and alcohol. Casino gaming has been a game changer for some tribes, while others are encouraging the growth of industry on their reservations. But social problems are still nearly crippling for many tribes. There is a growing issue of not only violence against women on poorer reservations, but a growing number of young girls who are becoming mothers. Traditional Native American culture, which values family and emphasizes a balance of the mind, body, and spirit, provides excellent models for sexual decision-making. Then why are so many Native American women starting families so young?
That's Gudji Cook, a midwife and women's health advocate from the Mohawk Nation, singing a song about the sacredness of a new day and the new life that it will bring. For centuries, American Indians have welcomed new babies into their families with elaborate ceremonies and prayerful songs like this one. Gudji, who is 59, says the average age of first birth among her ancestors going 7 generations back is 26. She had her first baby at 23. But today, 21% of Native girls will become a mother before turning 20, compared to 16% of girls nationwide, according to federal reports. Native youth as a whole are more likely than other youth to report having sex for the first time before age 16, and less likely to report using contraception.
I was 15 when I had my daughter.
I was 17 when I got pregnant.
I was 17.
I was 16 years old when I got pregnant.
I was 13 when my girlfriend got pregnant.
Those are voices from a video produced by the Cherokee Youth Council in North Carolina to inspire a conversation among other youth about preventing pregnancy. The reasons behind the high rate of unplanned pregnancy among young Native women are both simple and complicated. Patrina, a 20-year-old Navajo mom in Arizona, says one reason in her community may be that as soon as a young woman announces a pregnancy, she immediately assumes a special, revered position within the tribe. Her child's birth is an occasion for celebration, no matter what the circumstances were preceding it.
Us Navajos, we're all about family, so if a girl gets pregnant in your family, you're probably, like, kind of disappointed, but you know that they're bringing life into this world, and it just turns, like, the disappointed around to something positive. And so, like, I'm thinking, like, maybe because that all these girls are getting pregnant is because they know that their family are not really going to talk negative about you. They're not going to turn you away. They're going to, like, keep you closer to the family just because you're bringing another person into the world.
Such a reaction is understandable in light of the declining numbers of Native Americans to about 1% of the U.S. population. Mary Wachacha, health education consultant for the Indian Health Service, talked about this on the Cherokee Youth Council teen pregnancy film.
I remember once
when I was doing a session of the Parent Teacher Association, PTA, at the high school. And we were sharing with the parents that were there some of the things that we were going to be doing in the school for that coming year. And one of those was we were going to sponsor a teen pregnancy prevention program. I remember this old Indian man stood up, and he pointed his finger at me. And he said, "Who are you to try to stop these teen pregnancies?" He said, "The Cherokees over the years," he said, "we've been decimated by war. We've lost babies to disease. We welcome every child, whether that's to a girl that's 14 or a woman that's 24 or a woman that's 34.
Petrina, the young Navajo mom, went back to high school a couple of weeks after giving birth to her daughter, Natalie. She now attends Mesa Community College in Arizona. Her family helps raise Natalie, who's almost two. But not everyone has that kind of support. Jackson Harris works with Petrina and other young Native students through a mentoring program at Mesa. Harris points to the ongoing problems many Indian families face, including poverty, alcoholism, and the legacy of Indian children being sent to Christian mission or boarding schools. Sometimes they were sent by social services, or in Harris's case, by her own family.
Whenever I would ask my father, he would point to my mother. It was all her fault. And when I'd ask my mother, it was all my father's fault. So I never really got the full story. But I do know that they had alcohol problems, and they were just really not capable of being parents.
And who made that decision? Who decided, okay, these kids need to go to an orphanage? And who decided which orphanage you went to?
It was a mission school. It was supposedly supposed to be how my grandmother said to us when she told us she was going to take us there was, "I'm going to take you where they're going to teach you how to cook and clean and sew and teach you about the Bible." Those were the things that she thought she was doing for us. So that's where we ended up, because they didn't have anybody to take us. And so it was fire and brimstone. You know, you are not allowed to speak your language, and all of your ceremonies are Satanism because they're not in the church.
The history of children being separated from their families may help explain why some Native Americans harbor a deep distrust of outside values and approaches to medical intervention, including contraception. Jessica Yee, a young Mohawk, says that's one reason why, when it comes to making decisions about pregnancy and childbearing, autonomy is very important to young Native women. This is in part why she founded the Native Youth Sexual Health Network, run by and for Indigenous youth.
We as Native people have always strongly believed in the principle of non-interference, meaning supporting people to make the best decisions over their bodies. So when it comes to contraception, I think that that's no different.
Of course, says Jessica, girls and women need health providers for help with birth control and information in their traditional languages where possible. And drawing on Natives' reverence for community, she tells young women that while decisions about sex ultimately belong to them, they also need to consider the larger effect on families and tribes.
We start talking about our bodies at an early age, but not just isolated into the sexual or the reproductive health parts. But it comes along with a host of other things that are important and integral to that discussion for the good of the whole community.
Adrienne Morris, who's 33, is a member of the Anishinaabe tribe. She runs a program in Minnesota that teaches basic facts about the body and puberty that the schools no longer teach. The program, called Live It, consists of 11 sessions conducted in a traditional talking circle.
The goal of the program is to reduce teen pregnancy throughout Native country, Indian country. And with that, it's giving people tools to make better decisions.
The program also tries to help teenagers understand the impact of their particular legacies or family stories. Adrian's husband, Sam, put it this way.
When a culture loses its identity, it kind of grabs onto an identity that's not its own. Like for me, it was gangs and stuff like that. And we didn't have our cultural teachings that taught us, you know, about the future and how we were supposed to live our lives. So there was a recklessness. We just live for the moment.
That search for identity can have an influence on a number of life choices. Sam and Adrian weren't married when they had their first child, when Adrian was 17. By age 22, she had three children.
The lack of expectations really was a big part of it. My mother was an alcoholic, and so I spent most of my childhood raising my siblings. There's seven of us. I'm the oldest of seven.
Adrian thought a boyfriend would allow her to escape the chaos at home.
I threw myself into a relationship desperate for something because we weren't getting it at home. And then being that young and not thinking about the future or thinking about consequences.
If you're not receiving emotional support from home, it's unlikely you're going to approach your parents or other caregivers for help in getting birth control. I asked Petrina, the young mother at Mesa Community College, about that.
How often and how regularly do girls your age, how often do you use contraception?
Almost never. Or actually, yeah, almost never.
And why is that?
Well, I think it's mainly because our, parents don't really talk to us about it and we don't really know about it. And we're kind of we keep it a secret, I guess.
Have you had sex education in school?
I think only once, and that was in fifth or sixth grade. And that was a long time ago.
That is a long time ago.
Yeah.
So nothing since then?
No.
As I listened to Petrina, I realized that she, like many non-Native women, had been taught to think of sex as little other than an exercise of body parts, and contraception as simply a tool to keep you safe. Paying attention to the mechanics are what passes as sex education in this country. But Gudjie Cook, the Mohawk midwife, reminds us that mechanics only engage the mind. They do nothing for the spirit.
It's not all ovulation and insemination and implantation and gastrulation, the boring, privileged language of the biomedical expert. It becomes more deep, more meaningful when discussed in cultural terms.
Both mind and spirit are needed for motivation toward self-care, and linking the two together can start when children are very young.
I know when I was young, my mother would bathe me as a 5-6-year-old girl, and when she would wash me between my legs, she would tell me, "Someday a baby is going to come out of there. Keep yourself clean there." And so in those kinds of ways, she would message to me to respect my body. When the time came for me to begin my menses, I was already hearing my mother talk to my aunties about whether Grandma Moon was visiting me. And so in these poetic ways, we young women were brought into a good feeling about our bodies, about ourselves, and respected.
Native people often speak of the four elements of being, the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. All four must be engaged for a balanced life and balanced decision-making. And perhaps there's wisdom in that for all of us. I'm Laura Sessionstep.
Coming up, women and the rising Native nations, and the suffragette who said great cream biscuits and algebra didn't have to be mutually exclusive. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1271. According to the Southwest Center for Law, the rate of domestic violence and rape against Native American women is more than double that of other minorities. Karen Artichoker is the director of the Women's Shelter in Kyle, South Dakota. She sees those battered women firsthand. Rampant alcoholism among the Native population is part of the problem, but another problem is the isolation of reservation life. Anton Folk filed this report.
It's a small office, not too big, and Karen, I see pictures and posters on the wall. One of them says, "Even in thought, respect women. Women are sacred.
Yes, that's one of the teachings of the White Buffalo Calf woman, and she's the feminine entity that brought us our Lifeway teachings. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that's one of her teachings for men. Mm-hmm. And so our work is based on that notion that even in thought, women are to be respected. As tribal people, who we are as the collective is our priority.
Mm-hmm. If we talk about reality instead of entertainment, what would I talk about?
I think that we're an emerging nation, that we're...
Emerging?
Emerging. We're an emerging nation.
That sounds weird.
Well, you know, we have the status of being sovereign in this country. We're nations within nations, within this nation. We've never given that up. And so what you see occurring here is nation building. We're a country that never received any reconstruction dollars. You know, we were placed here as prisoners of war in a concentration camp with no or little assistance in rebuilding our nation. And so, of course, you're going to see many of the problems that come with that.
Such as?
Well, when you look at the problems we have here, you'll notice that our bad statistics are much higher than any other group of people in this country.
Statistics and, of?
Whether you're talking about child abuse and neglect, woman abuse, alcoholism, unemployment, suicide, poor health.
Poverty?
Poverty, unrelenting poverty. So you see those extremes. We're a colonized country, and you're going to see those extremes of the poverty, the poor health, all of that. On the other hand, you also see the incredible beauty of our culture, and I attribute that to what's helped us survive.
Recently, the Amnesty International organization issued a report talking about violence against Native American women.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think it's about time the international community recognized that there are human rights violations here, and particularly against Native women. When you look at the Department of Justice statistics, you'll see that really Native women are the most victimized population in the United States. Now, that's not what made the headlines when those reports came out. You know, it's gratifying that the international community is recognizing that violence against Native women is a major human rights violation. I think, you know, we do some national work through Chungleshka. We operate a national resource center, and we provide technical assistance and training to tribes and tribal organizations developing sexual assault domestic violence response. But by and large, we work at home locally. And we probably have, we estimate fewer than 30 shelters located in tribal communities in the United States. And I always tease my non-Indian friends on the national level that one of the things, statistics they like to cite is that there are more dog shelters than there are shelters for battered women. And I always say, well, yeah, to try having less than 30. So, you know, the goal of the national women's community was to have a shelter in every county or as many shelters as was necessary to accommodate women and help women be safe. That goal hasn't been achieved, and it certainly has not been achieved in tribal communities.
And finally, Gilles Malkin is back with another installment of Women in History and some things about Susan B. Anthony you probably didn't know.
Susan Brownell Anthony was born in Adams, Massachusetts in 1820 into a Quaker household. Her parents valued a simple life and personal discipline. The revolution she sparked was not caused by feelings against them, but was rather a continuation and an extension of what she was brought up to believe. Quakerism recognized women as equal in the eyes of God. As time went by, she would distance herself from the hypocrisy she perceived in the church, but by that time she had formed a life of principles and simplicity. but she found herself in a society in which all men are the accepted masters over all the women. You would think it'd be enough to hear her point out that nowhere in the Constitution, which guarantees rights to all persons, are men granted domination, for the courts to follow that simple concept. But aren't we still dealing with that issue today? Abolition of slavery and temperance were her first causes. It was upon reading an 1850 article by Horace Greeley about the first National Women's Rights Convention and the speech given there by Lucy Stone that Susan B. Anthony's heart and mind were galvanized into the firebrand advocate of women's rights. It was in Seneca Falls that she met Lucy Stone, Amelia Bloomer, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was to be her comrade in arms for the long years of work that lay before them. They fought for women's right to vote, as well as for the abolition of slavery, but it was not simple. The road was full of traps. For example, trouble came in 1869, when the 15th Amendment granted Afro-Americans the vote, but still not women. Anthony found herself at odds with her ally Frederick Douglass, who of course supported the measure which, unhappily, left women out in the cold. Advocating for women also put her on the outs with the National Labor Union, since the push for women's equality was not their priority. In 1872, she went to the polls and voted. She was arrested, tried, and fined for doing so. She and Stanton wrote the 19th Amendment, recognizing women's right to vote, which finally became law in 1920, 14 years after Anthony's death. She predicted that its passage was just as sure as her belief in it. These were not ordinary people, by any standard. After the Church of England issued a revised edition of the Bible in 1881, Stanton, dissatisfied with its neglect in its portrayal of the character of women, decided to correct it and put out her own version in 1888 to set the record straight. She was not alone among the feminists to do this. Lucy Stone had learned Greek in order to correct the standard translation into English, which she suspected was inconsistent with what she perceived to be the true character of the heart of God. Any attempt to list Susan B. Anthony's work would create a volume impossible to impart at any one sitting. She traveled throughout America and abroad, spreading the basic idea of women's suffrage and gathering friends and allies everywhere she went. Susan B. Anthony was brash and outspoken about her views, and she paid dearly for it by becoming the favorite target for political cartoonists and chauvinistic lampooners. These skewed attacks completely eclipsed her personal side, her warmth, and her dedication to her family. And to those close to her, she revealed a broad and generous nature and a depth of tenderness that few women possess. Her excellence as a housekeeper and a hostess was well known, as was her readiness at all times to receive even strangers and the poor to her table. Irene A. Beale, who wrote about Anthony's home life, said, "Her cream biscuits were legendary. A brother-in-law once declared he would rather a woman could make such biscuits than to solve the knottiest problem in algebra," to which Susan sensibly responded that there was no reason why she could not do both. Susan B. Anthony retired to her home in Rochester in 1900 and died there in 1906 at the age of 86. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is an actor, writer, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.